You're listening to the Adoption and Fostering Podcast from Misadventures of an Adoptive Dad.
Well, hello, Scott, and welcome to what is, I believe, the 23rd episode of the podcast.
23, blimey.
Big 23.
I know. I remember it well.
We were so young and happy when we started, weren't we? Fresh-faced, full of optimism and hope that everything was going to turn out okay.
Yeah, and it began with a two.
Yeah, there you go. Right, no need for banter. You've been away. How are you doing? Are you back? Everything back to work?
Yeah, I'm just looking at myself on the screen here. I'm thinking, cool, don't I look brown? Yeah. Yeah, I went away for, we were away for the 10 days. We had some lovely time away in a hot country. And we arrived back on Sunday. And yeah, it's all good.
Excellent. I had some holiday, but then I decorated.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but I really enjoy that. I like doing things with hammers and makes me very therapeutic.
Mm.
Yeah. Right. This episode, we're going to talk to our special guest. Who? Hello, our special guest.
Hello.
Hello. A little voice from beyond.
Yeah, I got lost for a minute then. I had to leave and join again, but I'm back.
Oh. Yeah, we didn't
I missed your I missed your conflab.
That's all right. There was nothing to miss. There was nothing to miss.
Okay, I'm back in the room.
Yeah, I assure you there's nothing particularly exciting about what we've got to say. Right, we're going to talk about life story work. So I have to say, I kind of anticipated a bit of a Twitter storm, but there's been a proper hoo-ha.
Oh, there has.
Oh, I know. But before we start, Katie, tell us who you are and why we're talking to you about life story work.
So my name is Katie Wrench. I'm a social worker. Work in Leeds. Been a social worker for about 17 years. Worked in a children's home before that. Trained as an art therapist. And it's while I was working as a therapeutic social worker that I got much more interested in life story work. Because lots of the young people who were being referred to my team for therapy actually just needed life story work, they didn't need therapy at all. So I'd start a piece of therapeutic work and realise that actually no one had ever helped these kids understand why decisions had been made about them or who they were or why they were living where they were living. So I ended up doing much more of that than I did doing art psychotherapy or any other kind of therapeutic work.
Was that just, I mean, was it just that it something that you were interested in and it kind of fell to you, or was it kind of by design that that's what happened?
No, it wasn't by design at all, because it was never our job to do that. It was not the job of our team. It was the job of those children's social workers to do the work. So most of the kids that we work with in our team and that we'd be doing life story work with are fostered children. And so it would have been their social workers that should have been doing that work, but for one reason or another, either no one had, or they'd written them a book but hadn't done any work with them to help them understand the book that had been written, or the book that had been written was so dreadful that it wasn't usable. So I just found myself doing more and more of it, almost by default, because I felt like if I didn't do it at that point, when that young person was ready, they might not ever get to do it. So I ended up doing more and more of it, got more and more interested in it, started to be a bit more curious, I suppose, about why social workers weren't doing it in a way that I thought was helpful. And it kind of went from there, really. Ended up writing about it. And I guess that's why you're talking to me, because I ended up writing about it a few years ago with a colleague of mine, Leslie.
Because I think I'd seen you, followed you on Twitter and kind of seen you add into those comments, and I met you a couple of months ago and I just thought, let's do this, because it's such a hot potato.
Yeah.
Before I go any further, I think that I've lost Scott. So I'm going to see.
I can only see Scott, but I can't see you.
Oh, I can only see Scott, but I can't see you.
I'm the only one that actually wants my face to be seen on this.
Oh, you were very quiet, Scott, and I started to worry that you...
I was listening.
All right, okay.
You answered a question, you have to let her finish, for goodness sake, man.
Right. Okay.
Honestly, you might be in charge of the tech, but I'm the boss here, so, you know, let's just...
That is the cruel reality. Well, that's... Right. That's really interesting. I've got lots of questions, and I kind of normally I lead the interview through with kind of my thoughts. But actually, is it okay if I just start with people's questions? Do you have any questions, Scott?
I've got loads of questions, but I just think that this is such a massive subject, a massive topic, and having had 3 children via the same local authority, I'm just really interested to kind of hear what the questions are for a start, but secondly, mm-hmm. Just all the information that comes out of it, because the differences in 11 years from one local authority have been massive. And what I mean by that is that 11 years ago, the life story work that was done was absolutely comprehensive compared to 3 years ago.
Really?
Which is the wrong way around for me. Yeah. And I'm sure it's the wrong way around for a lot of people. And it comes down to that old pound sign in my eyes. So I'm really interested. It's a hugely interesting topic for me. So I'm kind of just going to butt in when required.
I wasn't expecting you to say that. I was expecting you to say the other round.
Yeah, I know. I'm surprised that I said it, but that is the truth.
I suppose before I even start, can I ask one question? What is the law? There you are. Put you on the spot, Katie.
What's the law
in relation to life story work?
I think there is a law for children who are in care. I don't think there is a law. Yeah. There's guidance, isn't there, for children who are adopted that they should have the final life story book within 10 days of the final order being made. You should have the complete version. But I think there's also something about having a sort of part one before that, having a part one when the children come home, and then having that finished by 10 days after the adoption order is made. And I think the idea of that is so that, you know, there's the opportunity for that child's parents to be part of the story and for the story to connect much better for the whole family, really. And so there can be stories about that child with his or her parents in the life storybook, not just a story that's filled with life before they came home, is my understanding.
Right. Well, we'll go with your understanding because you're clearly the expert in the room.
I'm a bit scared about all these questions.
Right. Okay, I'm going to add two boys and us. First question was... Right. Well, it's more of a comment. Does it have to be a book? And how do we get social workers to understand that actually it is more than just a set of words that are presented to children?
You see, I think it depends very much on the age of the child at the time that you're doing the book and the work, because I think it doesn't have to be a book, does it? It can, and I think for a lot of older young people that we work with, they don't necessarily want a book. They might want to use more, I think somebody, Simon Hammond, has written about using digital technology in life story work, which I think has its complications in local authorities, actually, because there's so much information governance stuff around that, and not enough good tech belonging to the department that you can't use your own phones and recording stuff on iPads, so I think that gets a bit tricky. But no, I don't think it does necessarily have to be a book. I think for lots of kids, it's the process that's important as much as the end product. You want the end product to be a good end product that's usable and family friendly and appropriate for that child. Yeah. But it's the understanding of the story that's as important.
Because my views on the books are, as I'll be totally honest, I'm a life story work skeptic, but that's me being just probably being a bit arsy. I think that what I mean is that a book captures a moment in time. It's static. And it, you know, the book that you would write for a 4-year-old isn't what you'd write for an 8-year-old or a 14 or an 18.
Absolutely not. And I think there was a bit of a fad a couple of years ago in Leeds, and I don't know whether there still is in other local authorities. It must have got some money from somewhere. And all of a sudden, all the life story books that were written for children, not with them, for them, hard-bound, like proper books. So they looked amazing on the outside, looked like a proper book.
Yeah.
You can't add to that. That's almost like a sense, isn't it, that your story's over at that point that you get your book. So mine are never, mine aren't, when I do mine, they're not done as books. They don't look fancy because they're kind of loose leaf bound. Yeah. But they're loose leaf bound for a reason, so that, you know, you keep adding to it, so that children and young people have the option of taking bits out if they want to show the teacher or they want to show the friend bits of it that they want to share, they can. But it also means that parents and carers can take out bits if it's a one
bit sensitive kind of,
something that's sensitive or information that's not appropriate at the age that you're wanting to have those conversations with your child, you can take those bits out and they're there for when it is appropriate. And I think that's one of the big challenges for social workers when they're writing them, is kind of trying to anticipate at what point will it be used. So I think if it's loose leaf bound, you've got that option, haven't you, then, of adding those trickier bits or more complex explanations for a later time when you think your child is ready to understand it and process it.
Yeah. I think sorry, Scott.
No, I was just going to say that's really interesting because I saw the book that you're referring to a couple of months ago, and they still use it in one of the local authorities in Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. And it's very impressive. It really is. But actually, you're right. You can't add and you can't take away. And that's quite a key thing, isn't it?
It's a massive thing. And I think a lot of the time when I've kind of talked to children some time after they may have had their story, you know, the bits that they want to look at are the bits that are celebrating who they are, all the family photos and the achievements and the nice bits, if you like. They're the bits they want to keep coming back and looking at over and over again as they get older, in my experience. And to have the option of not having to be faced with that tricky bit, if you don't want to be, is really important, that you've got a choice about that, and it's not in a hard-bound book that suggests your life has ended at the end of that piece of work, because as Al said, it's something that should be continuing throughout your life, isn't it?
So I think that's where my objection comes to them, in the sense that in a biological, whatever normal family is, you wouldn't say, well, we're going to have some life story time now. It's this story that is woven into meals, and it's woven into family occasions and bedtimes, and it's this narrative that's continually unraveling and being, you know, you're peeling back the layers of this onion continuously. And to say we're going to do some life story work separates their life into something that's unusual or not part of who they are.
I absolutely agree, and I think when I'm thinking about doing, I've most of my work has been with children who have fostered. The last couple of years, I've done some little bits of work, since the ASF has arrived, with some adoptive families, and I think that for me is why I would always work really hard to have that child, parent, or carer in the room in the sessions when you're doing that life story work, because actually that's just a little tip of an iceberg. The work itself happens, like you say, every day when the opportunity arises, not for an hour a week when they happen to see me or the social worker, or the social worker comes to present a book. That's not when it happens. So I suppose I see the book in some ways as a way for some parents and carers to kind of have some help in having some of the more difficult conversations when they come up. Because I think that's sometimes one of the things that people find hardest is finding the right words. Yeah. So if you work together to think what words fit, how do we want to say this, what feels comfortable for me to say, you've got that then to refer back to. And I think sometimes parents and foster carers find that supportive, actually, that they've had a bit of a practice about how to say some of that stuff.
Because I think that's one of the other questions I'm just looking through. Starfish and me sort of talked about training for adopters, and I guess foster carers as well, saying, you know, what do we mean when we talk about life story, and giving people the skills to facilitate it themselves? Do you have a job?
I don't know very much about adoption preparation at all, actually.
No one does. It's a mystery. It's a mythical thing.
From what I've heard, it doesn't, life story work doesn't feature massively.
No.
Or with enough prominence. And I think it's the same for foster carers. I've done, been a short breaks foster carer for about 10, 11 years. And there was nothing in our training at all. Absolutely nothing. We used to, our team used to deliver life story training to foster carers in our authority, and that was stopped years ago for funding issues. So,
I
don't think it's great at all, to be honest. And my guess is as well, it depends very much from local authority to local authority in terms of what model they're using for writing their stories, for doing the work. Do they do the work or do they just write a story? I think I've visited a few local authorities now delivering life story training for social workers and different teams, and I think from authority to authority it's so different. Some of them are set up with teams who, where that's all they do, they write life story books for babies and toddlers who are going to be adopted. That's the job. So they never meet the children, they don't meet the adopters, they just are given the chronology and they're asked to write a book in a very, very short time frame, which makes my heart sink, really.
I mean, my experience, I have a couple of interesting experiences, but one, my most peculiar one was for my two daughters who we fostered then adopted.
Right.
And we kind of got a life story book when they were, it was just, it happened. But then we realised there was spelling mistakes in it, and it was laminated, and we said, well, do you think you could try doing things a bit differently? I had the picture of the street where their birth mum lived and the name of the street. We said, well, you know, as it's only 5 miles from where we live, there's a fair chance at 14 we know this is going to unravel. And we were just basically told, no, that's it. So we put it in a shelf and we showed it to our girls when they were old enough to read. And because we did life story work all the time, that's how we live. We showed it to them and they were six. They were pointing out the spelling mistakes.
Oh, Lord.
And then, so, which was a bit embarrassing, but then after that, my youngest daughter came, who's their sibling, and we presented the older books, and they said, well, that's terrible, shocking. Absolutely, we take full responsibility. We'll redo them. So they redid them, and they were much better. And one thing that really struck out to me was a woman came out, and she talked about the children when she got to know them. But then I realized that all of the clip art that was in the life story book was of white girls, and one of my daughters is black. And you kind of go, well, that's just really...
That's not right.
No. I mean, my girls see them in context, and we've got a peculiar life, so our life story works ongoing.
Who doesn't?
Yeah. Scott, you got any questions?
Oh, sorry. All I could hear was the noise of Al, to be fair.
Oh, shut up. Honestly,
well, I mean, it's interesting because 11 years ago we were one of the first kind of same-sex couples to adopt, and I think what was interesting about that was the wording around the book, the life story book. And I use I have my fingers in the air when I say that because I think a book is very different to life story. But but it was interesting how it was worded almost in, you could say, third person, but it was so abstract in some ways, but actually it works for what we needed at the time, because it was an unknown, and it's not the same as the cultural background of Al's kids, but you know, it's for the future sort of thing. So it was how to talk about parents and what kind of parents, and you know, because normally it was mum and dads, or but now, they were coming to family with dads. So that in itself is, I think, has moved on as a norm. So people see it more of a norm. But back then it was very much that they had to be careful. They worded everything. I don't know who they were more scared of upsetting, actually, us or the two boys. But it's just, you know, it's a real life story. It doesn't need to fucking up. It's, you know... It needs to be age appropriate, but not, you know, it doesn't need to be fluffed up in any way.
Were you consulted about how it was written or shown it before it was finished?
Yes, we were. But I think for us, with those two life story books, the main thing for us is that the boys had input into them.
Yeah.
So they were consulted on it. There was work done with them. They were visited. They had a really good relationship with their life story worker because they had one 11 years ago, because there was lots of money in local authorities 11 years ago.
Quirky.
And they had a lady who came around and she got to know them really well before she started to write the book. And it's very factual. It's fantastic. I mean, the 11 years ago, the two books were just, and still are, absolutely bloody amazing. They really are.
That's good to hear.
Yeah. But like I say, the same local authority, 11 years on, not quite the same story, which is very sad. Very sad indeed. Because obviously, you know, part of our younger son's story is the fact that he came from the same local authority. So when he looks at the books, he can see the difference.
He knows.
Yeah, he does. So it's an interesting...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, I've got a few more questions because there was actually a really interesting kind of conversation that trickled through the day, which was interesting, and you probably read it as well or followed it. And it was someone saying, actually, my children want nothing to do with this. And they, as an adopter, they were quite passionate. It was communicated passionately through their Twitter sphere. That was Feeling Mum Yet. I have to confess that I am a friend of Feeling Mum. I know her in real life as well. So I know her story, and she had a terrible life story experience where...
Is this where the social worker just came and took the boys in one room and did it in 2 hours?
Yeah.
Was it that one without her there?
Yes.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. She did have a dreadful experience. Yeah.
Yeah.
Her boys are a little bit older, aren't they? Sort of 6 and 8 or something like that.
That's right.
Yeah. That really upset me. I don't know her, and I don't know her children, but I found that really distressing to think. I remember reading it after it had happened, after I'd come to it late, so it had already happened that day, I think, or the earlier in that day, and I was reading it in the evening. And I remember her saying she could hear her children crying in the other room, and she was excluded from it. And that, So I can see why she would have very strong views about it, and why her children would as well.
Yeah.
And I think that she's made a complaint, hasn't she, about how that was managed? And I think she was absolutely right to do that. Do you know one of the things that upset me was that. I wish you'd have known before that happened that it was okay to say, no, you're not doing it like this. This is not a helpful way of doing this. If you've written a book, you know, leave it with me and I will share it when I think it's the right time for my children. If they're asking questions, or if they feel, you know, if I feel like it's the right time, and I'll do it as their mum and someone who can provide some safety around them during that. Not as someone just swooping in, and for her not to even have been present.
But I think that, I mean, it's not necessarily a life story work issue, but that strikes the heart of that relationship with social workers. And I sit on both sides of the table and I see it.
Yeah.
Especially in my early years of an adopter, I said, how high on the way up, when they said jump.
Yeah.
And I, yeah, hook, line and sinker, just did what they said, because social workers have power.
Yeah.
And even when they are lovely people, there's that implicit power in the relationship. And I think that freaks people out.
I think it's more of a hierarchy than power, personally. But, you know, you think social worker, you think actually they can make life-changing decisions for children, for families. So you kind of,
And I guess you would make an assumption that they would know what they were doing.
Yeah.
That's your job. It's your job to do that, so that you would be guided. Like when you go to the doctors and the doctor says, well, what do you want to do? You kind of want them to tell you, because that's what you're trained to do. But I think I've been to talk at a few adoption support groups about life story work. And what struck me there was people sort of saying, yeah, we might have been shown the book, but we weren't sure what one should look like. We weren't sure if it was a good one or not. And yeah. And then how do you challenge it if you don't really know what to expect from one? I guess if it's obvious stuff like dodgy clip art and dreadful spelling and grammar, and in some that I've seen that have obviously been cut and pasted when there's a group of brothers and sisters, and they've cut and pasted, the wrong names spelt wrong,
badly
spelt wrong, hospitals that children were born in wrong. It's just it makes you wonder why it's so hard, really, to get it right. And I think some of it is that, just as we were talking about adopters and foster carers' lack of preparation, it's the same for social workers. I don't know whether you got anything about life story work on your training, but I certainly didn't.
Not a sausage.
No. So you're kind of, people are making it up as they go along. And yeah. I think what tends to happen is there'll be someone in a team who's written one, and people think, oh, that's a good one. We'll use that as our basis in the next one, which is great if number one is brilliant. If number one's not good enough, then you've got 30 more that follow that same template.
And and I guess what we're saying is that we don't want templates. We want unique to the age, the experience, the context. My hunch is that often student social workers get to do it, because I was asked to do one as a student.
Yeah. Yes, I think they often do, and then they usually run out of time because it's a massive bit of work if you do it properly and you work with the children and don't just write a story for them.
And it's complicated. I mean, it was quite a while ago. It was 3 or 4 years ago now. But I got asked to do it for a young person who was in foster care. And actually, it was really hard to get some of that information. I had to go, the local authority had a secret bunker that was hidden, literally. It was a secret bunker that was hidden behind a kind of inconspicuous shop in a block of shops. And you had to go in and go to the back counter and ask for information. And they would bring out piles of files. It was a very surreal experience. But actually, there was nothing, even to the extreme where I asked a GP for details of where a child was born. No one gave it to me, so it's confidential. Really? And I kind of went,
gosh.
Yeah. So I had to get the head of service to write to the GP to say, can you please just tell us which hospital this child was born in? Flames and brimstone. And then there's that whole, but that's when we're off topic again, but another comedy social work experience. A few people are asking, I can't remember her Twitter name, I only know her real name. Oh, damn blast.
Don't do that.
Oh, that can all go wrong. Now we are six. That's it. Now we are six. Was
asking, I just have visions of something going on. I go, oh my god, is that a real name?
And that was the end.
Can edit that out.
Because I think quite harshly, he has to. I'm quiet tonight. I'm never normally this quiet.
No, I think that you've got some sort of work going back to work hangover, haven't you?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah. Slacking. Don't feel sorry for him. Honestly, he lives a Saint-Tropez lifestyle.
I believe.
It's all blind. Just more holidays than the Queen. Right. Anyway. The question from Now We Are Six was actually small child, a really complicated story. Not necessarily traumatic, but lots of moves, lots of complex of relationships with foster carers. Where do you start and what age do you start? I mean,
having the conversations.
Yeah. I mean, I think I know the answer, but
soon as possible, I would have thought. It's about, I guess, one of the things that I like to do for very little people is do a kind of, some people call them metaphorical stories, some people call them parallel stories, where there's a story about, mine often tend to be about a monkey family, I don't know why, but where you've got little figures or animals and you tell that child's story through metaphor, really. Again, these are copped up on a regular basis because you see monkey families with the same names as the children and their birth parents, and that's not the point. The point is to try to help begin that processing in a one-step removed kind of way, which for lots of littlies is the most helpful way to start, really. So you can start having some of those more complicated conversations, but about the monkey family or whoever it is that you're working with. So if you've got a little story that's written like that, and you've got the little characters, then what you can do is play the story out rather than having to use words necessarily.
Yeah.
That allows for different understandings then, because children kind of have a bit of control over the narrative, over what they think and say to different people in that story. So quite often I use those. In an ideal world, I think all children, all littlies who need a life story book should start with that kind of a story, have a life story book for sort of 8, 9-ish, and then another version for when they hit the teens or adolescents, when they can accommodate different levels of information. But I know that that's a bit of a fantasy world I'm living in. And
were you saying something, Scott?
No.
You say that, but I think one of my thoughts is that actually as parents we need to take control of these stories and give our children what we need. And that links back to what you said, Scott, about us thinking, oh well, life story work is this other thing, this special thing that is there, is given to us by social workers who know what they're doing. They're trained, they're wise individuals. But actually take control of your own child's narrative. People were commenting, what about when you don't know the story? But with what you've got, tell the story that you can.
I think you do the best, don't you, with what you've got. And gaps are part of the story, aren't they? And gaps for me, when I'm doing the work, the life story work, are one of the biggest bits of the work, actually, because sometimes it is about, coming to terms with the fact that there are gaps and there are some things that we won't be able to answer, and there's loss and separation and grief in there, isn't there, which all needs attention. So I think the gaps are often, as pertinent, aren't they, as the facts or the things you think are facts, and are there to be worked with and to have the feelings about them validated, actually. And I think the best people to do that are parents and carers, because they are the ones that know when those conversations are the most appropriate to have, and they're rarely during a formal let's sit down and do some life story work. While you're eating your tea or you're in a car or you drive somewhere, something triggers a memory, or it's that, and that's the bit, isn't it, is having the confidence to have the conversation at the time when your child needs to have it. And they'll control that to a large extent, won't they? But I think the other massive thing, what I've really learned in this last year or so of working with a few different adoptive families, is that they have all been so open and as honest as they can with the facts that they've got for the children at the age they are about their kids' stories, that it just means that it's absolutely normal to talk about. It's not a big deal. It's not life work. It's just, we're chatting about stuff, and that's really impressed me, I have to say, because I think some of the time those conversations are really difficult, but it's meant that their kids know it's all right to have the conversations. It's not shameful, it's not a secret, it's not something they should feel bad about, just something you talk about like you talk about other things.
Do you get the sense, is that a contemporary view, or is that just unique to those individuals, or do you think that's just a change in culture? Or
I can only speak, I guess, for the families that I've worked with, and it's not, and that's a small number of families, but I also know of more anecdotally of, in particular, actually with some, we've had a number of young people come back into our care where as teenagers, where adoptions have disrupted, and in most of those cases, it's been where those young people haven't known that they were adopted, and that bombshell has kind of emerged, if you like, at 14, 15, and
whoa.
very difficult to manage. So I think that is still happening.
I need to stop you there, and we need to talk about that. Is that really still happening?
Yep.
Wow.
We've had a couple of young people fairly recently, in the last year. That is happening. And I think, again, this is just anecdotally, because that's all I can give you. But I was doing some training up in North Yorkshire. They are completely revamping how they do their life story work and write their stories. And I've been working with the whole, they're training the whole authority. It's bad. Yeah. But I was talking to someone about what one of the things, they put all sorts of details in their stories because they kind of feel like they've got that one shot, so they want everything to be in there. But as a result, the things that they're putting in the stories are just not going to be suitable to share with children until they're in adolescence, probably. There's just too much because they don't want to miss that opportunity. One of them was talking about a family that they were working with where the parents were saying, oh, it doesn't matter what you write, we won't be showing it them, and we don't think they need to know, and they're too little to remember. So, essentially write what you want, but you're wasting your time and not using it.
Flames and brimstone.
I think it is still happening a bit. I'm sure those are isolated cases. I'm sure they are, because that's not been the experience of the families that I've met. But I think it does still happen because people are scared, aren't they? And I think there's still this myth, to an extent, that if you're teeny tiny, you won't remember. We know that that's not true, don't we? Might not have a verbal memory, but the brains and the bodies are remembering.
I mean, I hear anecdotally, like you, from time to time, people say, "Oh, I know, and Mrs. So and So down the street. She's not. Everyone knows little Johnny's adopted, but no one's told him yet." Mm-hmm. And you kind of go, "Whoa, that's just freaking me out."
Yeah.
But I do think I was reading a book that was a bit odd about adoption, but it said fear is the greatest enemy of adoption, and I think people are frightened. They don't want to do the wrong thing.
Yeah. Or say the wrong thing, I think that's a big bit of feedback I get from social workers when I'm delivering training, is they're worried that they'll make things worse, that they'll say or they'll do something that will make things worse, and that's the last thing we want to do, isn't it? That's not what we came into this job to do, to make things worse. But that's the biggest fear: we'll make it worse, we'll re-traumatise them by talking about traumatic things, we'll make things worse.
It beggars belief, because my understanding is that as long as you're not ramming home conversations, if you open a conversation, you're led by a child, and if they ask you a question, you answer it.
Because my kind of rule of thumb is, if you're asking a question, you're ready to hear an answer, aren't they? They might not need the full kind of chronology, but they need a version of that story that fits for their age and their developmental stage. And for me, that's a bit of a given. But I think then it's hard finding the words sometimes, isn't it? Like you say, some of our kids' stories are so difficult or so complex that you just think, well, where do I start? So I get that it's not easy.
I mean, there's a couple of things that are making real sense to me out of this. And one is the car thing, because we get that all the time.
Yeah.
It's like you're in the car, so you've not got eye-to-eye contact and questions are asked.
Yes.
And it's the most amazing time to be able to impart information. It really is. And also, and this is going to sound really quite strange, but I don't know about how you feel, Al, about this, because obviously we both adopted twice, shall we say. Right. And the learning that you get from that first time of trying to explain things and the do's and the don'ts, actually, do you know what? There should be books written about this stuff. From people who have experienced that, because the way we deal with life story work the second time around is completely different to the way we've dealt with it the first time around. Because I guess what you were just saying there, Katie, about re-traumatizing the child, is always in your head. If you deal with, I'm looking at it from a social work perspective, I guess in some ways, if you're a social worker and you've got one chance, one hit with this child, maybe to write a book, whereas as parents, obviously it's ongoing, isn't it? So, but for a social worker, you don't know if that is going to have a lasting effect on that child, if it's going to re-traumatize them, or if it's going to have a positive impact or whatever. So it's such a difficult thing. And I guess that what would be the ideal would be for the same person to see that child through to, you know, in their life story to a point where they, you know, if they ever get to the stage where they come to terms with what's happened to them and their life story. But that doesn't happen.
No. And I think it because it happens as children develop and with the cognitive development, the social emotional development, it does happen over a lifetime, doesn't it? It's not just in a 12-month piece of work or a 3-year piece of work. Or I think in our, because once you join my team, you just don't ever seem to leave. So what? But the good bit about that is actually I can think of children that I've worked with when they were 6, non-verbally, creatively, art therapy. It was life story work, but there were no words attached to it.
Yeah.
And then again at 11, just as they were doing that transition to high school, and then again at 15, because they needed different kinds of help with understanding at different stages. And that's a great thing to be able to do, but you're right, it happens, you know, it's not it's going to happen infrequently, isn't it, really, that you've got those options.
But that goes back to equipping parents, doesn't it? And carers, because I know that I remember really profoundly feeling this sense of repeating exactly the same information to my eldest daughter. That wasn't particularly difficult.
No.
But saying it to 6 and her taking it at one level and feeling quite sad about that.
Yeah.
And then explaining it again at 10 in almost identical words, but her understanding. She knew what that meant. And then again at 14, when you've flicked slightly and you understand a bit more about the world and what different things mean and the implications of certain lifestyle choices.
Yeah.
And exactly the same words. But the grief was a maturing grief. And, you know, that's cool. But for us, the life story work, we're very open, and Paula, the good Mrs. Coates, has always said she's incapable of not telling the truth. So every question that was asked, she just tells them. And we've always said at 18, I mean, Penny Carey said this, at 18, if they don't know by 18, they could walk into the social services office and get the information.
Read it all, And read it all, not written in a way that you would want your children to read about their stories. You want it coming from you, don't you? In language that fits for your kids, that is sensitive. I always have this thing in my head that when I'm writing stories, I want it to be truthful, but I want it to be compassionate. I want it to be compassionate for everyone in that story, because that I very strongly feel that that's the right thing to do. That's my little mantra in my head when I'm writing them. But equally, you know, I'd be lying if I said that, you know, for certain stories or for certain children where I've had to talk about difficult things, that I've not been around pretty much everybody in the team and practiced it, you know, because I have and I still would, because it is important to get it right. And I think a lot of the time where they are really tricky things that you're talking about, or even less tricky stuff, you know, I always check it out with a foster care or check it out with the parents. How do you want, how are we going to say this? What feels right to you? What do you think?
Words do you want to use for things?
Words do you want to use? Yeah. Some I've done something, I've been writing one at the moment, I have a story at the moment, and I'd written something that's kind of fairly innocuous, but can't even remember what it was now. But as soon as I showed this little girl's mum, she says she won't get that. It was something about when she was born, time of year or something, and she'd said something about I can't remember how I'd written it, but it was something about there was something about that day that was significant to them because that's what they talked about. It was a special day because of X. I'm not going to say what it was, but so you change it, don't you? You change it so that it connects with that little girl. It's got to be what's something that connects for her and her mum, not what I think is the right thing to have in a story. It's those little nuances, I think, that make it, that make those stories individual and connect, and not just a chronology that somebody's written for you.
A list of facts.
It's the same reason that, that every single story I write will be checked by somebody else before I show it to the parents or the carers, and before it goes finally to the children and the young people, because I don't want there to be a spelling mistake or a grammatical error or a factual error or something that they won't understand because I've used some
potentially. As social workers, we write stuff, and it doesn't last that long. But a life story book you give to a 3-year-old in 80 years' time, that could still be on the shelf of a 3-year-old, and it's likely that it will be. So it really, it might become a treasured possession that sits on a book and at times is pulled off, and you want it to be fairly good. I have some more questions, because literally Twitter's on fire and it's getting late. A few people asked, let me see who it was, in relation to learning disabilities, ID parenting and T+5, we haven't really talked about the specific needs of children in relation to their comprehension other than age. Do you do life story work with children with learning disabilities? What's your thoughts, experience on that?
When I read that, I thought that was about explaining where birth parents had learning disability or autism. You're talking about kids.
Read it much better than me, because I was in a hurry.
I was only scanning it. Yeah, we do. Yes, I do. Because a lot of our kids have, they might not have a learning disability, but they have difficulties with attention and concentration and the short-term memory and holding on to information and taking on board new information, especially if you don't have the parent or the carer in the room for an anchor to a bit of safety. I think it just takes, and I've done a couple of bits of work actually with children with autism. The first one challenged my whole way of working. Because I like to work, I'm an art therapist, I like to work creatively, I like to, I like to do things creatively, and he just did not want to do that at all. He wanted to do things using lists. I had to work so closely with his mum, she's his special guardian now, she was his foster care at the time, to help me work out what fitted for him, because it took him probably about 8 months to be able to tell me if something that I was saying or doing wasn't right, or he hadn't understood me, because I'd not got the language right and I'd not been clear enough. That was not a classic bit of life story work from my perspective, and his book isn't how I would normally write one, but it's right for him. Took a long time of dipping in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out and doing other bits of work in and around it. He couldn't tolerate just doing it in one stretch where it was just life story work every time we met. He just couldn't do it. And he would never have been able to do it without his mum in the room helping us navigate the way, or helping me really navigate the way to communicate best with him. But more recently, I've tried to do a bit of work with a girl who just got an autism diagnosis just before we started the work, and her mum tried, but she has got a life story book which neither me or her mum think is really fit for purpose, but in her mind she's got one, so why on earth should she need another one? Why should she do any work with me, because she's already got a book? So I've been sacked. Why don't you be sacked by her? She's not having it. We tried various ways of trying to think of what might work better for her, but she just doesn't want to do it. So I'm just working with her mum and helping her mum think about how to have some of those conversations, because she is asking questions and her mum just wants some help in thinking about how to respond.
Which kind of links to what Feeling Mum Yet sort of said about, actually she didn't really want to do it. The children are just not interested. But, that question was perhaps a bit larger about, should you even tell the children about it, just forget about it. It was quite a heated conversation. I understand why.
Yeah, I do too.
But that links back into people not telling the children, going, actually this is just crap, and how could I ever I've talked to the family and they said, I don't even know how to explain the things that have happened to this child. The things that I can't even, I don't even know the words for.
But do you know what's interesting is that we've dipped in and out of life story kind of work over the years, and for the, I'd say for the last five of the older two, we've not, the books lie with dust on and there's never any discussion about it, because not because we don't want to speak about it, obviously, but if we approach it, they're just not interested. And I don't know if that's a difference in the kind of the detail and the work that was done with them back 11 years ago compared to our younger one. I don't know. It could be. Maybe they just get it, or maybe they understand it. I mean, it doesn't mean that it's not affected them, but it's just very different. So they do lie. They lie in their rooms where they're accessible to them. They're not damaged. They're not, you know, pages aren't ripped out in temper and all that sort of stuff. They just lie there. They've been unopened for so long.
But they're not needed now.
Yeah.
They're not needed. And maybe that is because someone did such a good job all those years ago. I suspect it's also in part due to those conversations in the car. That, you know, if you can have conversations in the car, you don't need to go back to keep going back to the book, do you? So the book's almost there as a bit of a point of reference to help families have conversations, I think. And to remind kids how brilliant they are, because that's what I want my stories to always be. That I want, you know, I want them to finish the stories and think, yeah, I'm brilliant, me. You know, just to feel proud of themselves. And they're the bits that kids want to keep coming back and looking at. Because why would you not? We love stories about ourselves, don't we? I want those positive stories in there as well as the tricky stuff.
Because we've got a big family, so we don't often manage to get us all in the same room together as much as we used to. But we inevitably get back to the family stories. We inevitably get back to, do you remember the time when? And you said this. My daughter, infamously, 3 days after moving in, and the first time she'd met my mother, she was in the back of the car, my daughter said, and she said, if we don't get home soon, I'm going to piss my knickers. Honestly, I just thought, what have we done? I'm going to kill it. But it's those stories about this. We talk about, you know, and part of the story is the culture clash about this little ragamuffin who came into our lives. And she loves that because it's a funny story, you know, and it's not the language she would use in our family. And my mother, especially my mother's like the queen.
And your little one flicking the V in the back of the car.
Oh, by jingo, she's a minx. Well, isn't that one.
For me, if I was writing your daughter's story, they're the stories that should be in a book, aren't they? They're the stories that you want capturing. The funny stories, the little anecdotes, the things that are special to your family. And if you can, to the birth families, because all families have funny stories, don't they?
Yeah.
They all have stories that are special to them. And they're the bits that are hardest to dig around and find often, because you can get all the stuff that went wrong in a chronology, can't you? But where do you find the funny stories? They're the bits that I always want to dig around and find.
You never hear of them, do you? And you're right, there must be some, you know, regardless of all the issues and the trauma and the abuse and neglect and all that sort of stuff, there must be
I think you've given me a lot to think about, and I think the thing that struck, I made some notes because I'm anal, but one thing that you said that really struck me was the gaps. Is that actually making sense of the gaps? Because I've got really good links to my children's birth family, so I can fill lots of gaps, but there's gaps. And I have questions, and I just said, I don't know.
No.
So what do you do when there is a gap? How do you help a child make sense of a gap?
I let them know that I've done everything I can to try to fill the gap. That's the first thing. And I think that's really important, that somebody's taking the time to try to find out what you want to know or to try to fill the gap. So I would always do that. And then I guess there's just something about having some space for having feelings about that gap, actually. Whatever the gap might be, the gap in knowledge, the sadness, the rage, the disappointment, the making some space for that, actually, and sitting with it. Because I think that's the other thing, is that we can be quick, can't we, to try to make it better, to say, oh, well, we don't know that, but what we do know is blah, 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 blah. We've got this, found this for you. Look, I have got this picture. But actually, there's something I think that's really important about not doing that and validating that those feelings, accepting them.
Being allowed to be sad.
Being allowed to be sad, to be furious with me, because I found that information, but, you know, to have a right to know that somebody has gone and trawled through those 20 files in the back room of the shop, you know, that somebody's or that they've made every effort. I'm supervising someone at the moment who's working with a 15-year-old boy who is yearning for his birth father is so immense, it takes over everything. It is taking over his life. And this woman has got really kind of pulled into doing whatever she can to track him down, to find him, and to get him to the point where at one point she was saying, I've got an address, it's an hour and a half away from, I'm tempted to just go and knock on the door.
See what happens. You
can't do that. Let's go on your own and knock on the door. You know, what we know about this man tells us that might not be a very safe thing to do. You can't. But that's that thing, isn't it? I think for this young man, you know, there will be something at some point. It might not be now, but maybe it might be in 5 years' time that he thinks, well, she did her best to find him. She did her best to find that information out. And even if you don't
mean something, can't it? That can.
I think it does mean something.
Someone's bothered.
It might not do in the moment, because actually you might just be too busy feeling really angry and disappointed, and that it's not fair that other people have access to that information about their lives and their families, and you don't. That isn't fair, is it? And I think sometimes it is about just sitting with that and exploring those feelings and accepting them, not trying to make it better, just sitting with it. Which is really hard, isn't it? Because it's hard to sit through pain like that. But I think that is really important. It's not gloss it over. Try and pretend it's all right. It's not all right that you don't know that.
That's the truth of it. I'm aware that we're on the hour. We've had our magic hour of podcast. And
we get complaints if we go over an hour. Don't we?
Whatever we do, we get complaints. We foster a militant audience, don't we?
Oh, yikes.
Yeah. Oh, right, before we go, Katie, what's the name of your book? Katie Wrench's Big Book of Life Stories.
Life story work with children who are fostered or adopted, creative ideas and activities. And it's by me and my good friend, Leslie Naylor. Pink. It's very pretty.
Good. Right. Send me catchy a link title. To it on Google, and I'll put it in the thing, and we can boost your book sales by at least 3.
Yeah, brilliant. I think half of those people who ask questions have already got it.
Oh, I was going to say, then you can always a drink next time we see you.
Aye, I'll send you a pink book.
Oh, that's fantastic. Scott, questions? Any questions?
There's so many questions, but I think that this is potentially something that we need to revisit again.
Yes.
And if Tori will come back, then that would be lovely, because I do think that it's one of those topics, isn't it, that will continue to develop, and it will continue to be talked about, and it will continue to be an issue for people. And I just think that it's a little bit like, you know, attachment was 10 years ago, where nobody knew really what it meant. We're now getting to that kind of the crux of it with Life Story, aren't we?
Yeah,
and it not just being about a book, it's about a story, it's about an ongoing
process, isn't it? And I think one of the things that I would really like to talk about, because it is a bit of a thing that just keeps cropping up, is just that I know that more and more families will be applying to the ASF for therapeutic life story work, and I think it'd be good to think about or think of a way of helping families to quality assure what they're being offered, because I have some worries about that too, just on that bombshell.
<We'll Yes. finish. laughs> Well done for bringing that up right at the last minute. Yeah.
No, it's true though. I think, you know, it's a whole cottage industry, isn't it now?
Yeah, any numpty can use clip art, can't they?
Yeah,
exactly. Right? Yeah, but it's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'd
because there's a nuance between what is actually standard. You know, what you know, what we should be doing as parents, when what then tips it into therapeutic? What makes it?
Yeah.
You know, if everything's therapeutic, in some ways therapeutic is a nonsensical phrase, isn't it? You know, everything's therapeutic. But what tips it into that from beyond what is expected as standard to anything above and beyond?
I think the standard should be therapeutic, don't you? I don't think there's a difference. I think that there are some schools of thought that it is different. I don't get it because why would you do it if the purpose wasn't for it to be helpful?
So,
and that surely is what therapeutic is.
So what we can clearly say is that unless it's therapeutic life story work, it's not worth having.
No, it's not. And if you're not involved in it, it's not worth having. If they can't tell you what model they're using and how they're going to write their story, it's not worth having. You don't want someone who's making it up as they go along, do you? Want someone who's done this work before, who's experienced it, who's hit pitfalls, who's worked with families, who's worked collaboratively with parents and foster carers.
Are you on LinkedIn?
Yeah, I am on LinkedIn.
I don't even know what LinkedIn is. My emails get full of it. It's one of life's great mysteries.
I am. I don't really do very much on it, but here I am.
But there you are. You are clearly the lead therapeutics life story work woman.
I think some would argue against that. I have some rivals.
Do you?
Yeah.
I was going to ask you who, but I can't. Would that be wrong?
Oh, I've just added you on LinkedIn, Katie. There you go.
Have you
found me?
Oh, he's stalking you on the internet again.
Yeah, that's it.
Honestly, all of our guests, I have to put them through a series of counselling sessions afterwards because they have to use Skype. They have to give the email address and that's it.
Doomed.
Yeah, you're doomed. Not me.
I mean, I just met him once, and now he's coming to my house this weekend.
You're going on holiday together.
No, definitely not.
No, but there was a comedy moment a few weeks ago where people thought we were married.
Yeah, that was funny. It was very funny because I've got better taste. But anyway, I think that's
on that note.
Yeah, on that note.
Oh, we've slipped well and truly into banter there. Anyway, that's been wonderful. Thank you very much, Katie, and friend nice of the show. We'll have to have you back on.
We will definitely.
And yeah. Scott,
I've just got an invite to connect.
There you go. Yeah. What can I say? Look,
and while we've been doing this,
my real name as well.
I'm gonna delete that. Don't know.
Yeah.
Right, I'm ignoring you now.
There are government agencies.
Just before we go, we're hopeful to be recording something over the weekend because we are face to face, you and I, Mr. Al.
Yes.
And we're hoping to do something with our partners, which could go either way. And our children will be present as well, which will be even more interesting. So, but also the Twitter poll that I stupidly ran the other day.
Oh yeah.
We will be doing some comedy kind of art on Scott running.
Oh.
Because nobody wanted to see Al have a drink, which I thought was quite sad, actually.
Because we've got a Facebook page now, so on Facebook page we can live stream podcast videos.
Ah.
So while we were talking, Scott was secretly videoing himself looking bored when I was talking.
As long as he's not videoed me in my pyjamas.
No, you're right. I can't see you. You're fine.
Well.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah. Go anyway. And like us on Facebook and you'll be totally mortified and dismiss him from LinkedIn straight away. Anyway, we're prattling on now.
Yes, we are.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, it's nice to talk to you both.
And you. Thank you very much.
Ta-ta.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.